The KPFA edition of this show is a fundraiser for the station. If you like Behind the News and want to keep it coming, please contribute to this noble experiment in community broadcasting, which is about to celebrate its 65th birthday. It's simple. No contributions, no KPFA. No KPFA, no Behind the News. But there are also 167 hours a week of fine programming other than Behind the News and KPFA that also deserves support. So if you're in the U.S., you can call 800-439-5732 to make your pledge, or if you prefer, pledge securely online at kpfa.org. But however you do it, please pledge. And if you do, be sure to mention Behind the News. You can get the Atlas of California featured in this program for a pledge of $120. Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, an extended interview with Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography at Berkeley and co-author, along with Suresh Lodha, of the Atlas of California, Mapping the Challenge of a New Era, published late last year by the University of California Press. The Atlas, produced by the same people, I might say, who put out my State of the USA Atlas 20 years ago, Myriad Editions, were masters of this sort of thing. The Atlas is a beautiful artifact, 128 pages of maps, graphics, and prose about California, its physical layout, its people, its economy, its history, its ecology. Concise and eye-catching, but with a rich political intelligence behind it. Okay, here's Richard Walker. Welcome, Dick. First, a disciplinary question. Geography. I think to a lot of lay people, geography is all about atlases and maps and things like that. You're not that kind of geographer, so... First of all, just give us a sense of what geography, as you practice it, is about and what this adventure in map-making was like for you.
Yeah, you know, I came into geography by the back door and I from economics, and I'm basically a social scientist or a social historian. And when I first came in, the old geographers would say, "Hey, Dick, where's your maps?" And I kind of brushed them off. But over the years, I've come to realize that maps and cartography are a very important part of what we do, and they're actually fantastic for showing certain evidence of what's going on in the world. So, and fortunately, geography has become more well-known and better regarded in the social sciences, I think, in general in the United States than it used to be. So all that kind of comes together to end up bringing me into doing an atlas for the first time in my life.
What is geography as a social science, as rather than a branch of cartography?
Well, as a social science, it's a study of where things take place, what difference place and spatial relations, location make in the world of things like urbanization. Who studies cities? Well, geographers have been studying cities for a very long time. Other disciplines jump on board, but it's something absolutely fundamental to us. Regional development. If what we call international relations started off as geography. And then, of course, there's on the environmental side, geographers have been interested in how human beings have interacted with the face of the earth. For a very long time, we were some of the first voices in conservation, environmental studies, and so on. Again, a lot of other people have jumped on board, especially in the United States, where geography has been a kind of second-tier discipline. But if you go abroad, if you go to England and the former British Commonwealth countries like Canada, geography is often the number one choice of undergraduates as majors.
Okay, now, this Atlas of California, you had a co-author, first of all. What were your contributions?
Well, my co-author, Suresh Lodha, is a professor at UC Santa Cruz. He's Indian by origin, and I think Indians, educated Indians, are often very much enamored of the old British tradition of geography and of maps. And he had done a social atlas, an atlas of social justice in the world, just before this. with a friend, an old friend of mine, Ben Crow. And Ben, when Suresh said, oh, I think I'd like to do a California atlas because I've lived here now for a generation and do the similar kind of thing that we did of the world. And Ben said, well, why don't you talk to Dick Walker? And UC Press, which is part of the American publishers of this, they also suggested me. So I was just going to be an advisor. I thought, oh, this will be just a sideline. I'll give him a few tips because he's an engineer and a real data guy. So he's looking to me for some of that background knowledge of California. But, you know, as often happens in this life, you start a project sort of on the side and it ends up consuming you, and that's what happened with this one. I just got sucked into it, thought it was more and more fascinating, and ended up as the first author, quite by surprise.
So California, big place. You've been there for, what, your whole life?
Well, basically my whole life with a few periods outside.
What was your conception? What was the story you're trying to tell with the Atlas?
Well, that's a good question. I think we're trying to capture the current state of California, state of things, which particularly in the Great Recession was pretty bleak and raised a lot of questions for anybody on the left about social injustice and problems of economic meltdown and impact, things like foreclosures and homelessness and so on. So it was a way of painting a picture, doing a portrait of California. But in addition, I've been working for a long time on California, and I'm trying to write a book on the historic development of California as a region, its political economy. And for me, it was a good chance to sort of think about the relationship between what made California so successful and what's also made California in some ways such a pressure point for capitalist failure and for meltdown and social injustice in our time. Because I've been working on this history of California, I have a theme or a riff about the sort of mythology, the making of the mythology of California, and how it's been misunderstood. There's just a lot of silly ideas about, you know, sunshine and Superman building California, as opposed to actual deep foundations of political economy, of class structure, immigration, labor exploitation, racial relations, and development of technologies and so on. So I'm grappling with that. I put a bunch of that in the introduction to the Atlas to sort of say what made California great, and I think we wanted to reflect also why California is still a very powerful center of contemporary capitalism. But at the same time, I think a lot of things have gone wrong. A lot of the bases, foundations for the long-term growth of California have been undermined. So that's also behind many of the themes, many things we were trying to highlight in the specific topics in the Atlas.
Yeah, funny. I do detect, as I was reading the book, a mix of California patriotism, almost boosterism in places, at the same time, anxiety and creeping gloom about the present and future of the state.
Yeah, my friend Ian Bull likes to say I'm the only Marxist booster he knows.
It's a little unusual, but I feel similarly about New York City, so I guess, you know,
we can
all be selective boosters. All right, now let's then turn systematically to the contents of the Atlas. What people think of as geography, I think, the physical layout of the land. How did that, what were the general patterns of the physical geography, and how did that shape settlement?
Well, of course, the big thing in modern times is the gold rush and silver rush that brought people from around the world into California, put California on the world map. There obviously is a lot of human history before that. There's an imperial history before that, and we do touch on it. You certainly touch on the fate of the Native Americans in the face of colonialism and conquest, which is pretty grim. But at the same time, California, because it has interesting geology, it has a lot of minerals. And those minerals were the first thing that made California rich. And everybody knows about the gold rush in Northern California, which put San Francisco on the map. What a lot of people don't realize is that Los Angeles was not made by sunshine and screenwriters and screen stars, but was really made by oil. It was an oil rush that got L.A. off the ground in the early 20th century.
California is also the product of dual imperialisms. There's the Spanish-Mexican adventures, and then the Anglos came in and displaced the Spanish. But how did that affect the development of the state?
Well, the southern part of the state in particular was heavily influenced by the Mexican-Spanish legacy, for sure. But then it was left behind during the Gold Rush period. And the Gold Rush period erased a lot of that legacy, in fact. But you couldn't get away from it in the long run because since California and the whole Southwest were formerly part of Mexico, it was almost inevitable that, for instance, Mexicans would come back in large numbers to inhabit California, as they've done, and making it the most Latino, the biggest Latino population in the country.
California has been a magnet for immigrants for forever. What were the waves of people? You mentioned the Gold Rush, but what waves subsequently to that that settled the state?
Oh, well, it's been a mix of almost everybody. That's what's amazing. I mean, you not only had Americans coming in from the Gold Rush, but you had Europeans, people running away from the defeated revolutions of 1848. You had a massive influx of Chinese. People don't realize how big the Chinese influx was, even in the 1850s. And subsequently, you've had people from the South, from the West, and from the East. That is, Americans and Euro-Americans. You've got Latin Americans from all over, not just Mexico. And you have Asians of a wide variety. And you've really had wave after wave. California was almost unique in that having the first time in its history since the Gold Rush that there were more people born in the state than came in as immigrants was in the 2000s. So this has been a place, a roiling place, full of new people coming in, new energy, new labor. A lot, of course, skilled labor coming in, people with money coming in and setting up businesses and so on. And this is a very important part of what makes California tick and what's made it successful.
Has the rate of immigration slowed as the economy has sputtered and social tensions seem to have risen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, the economy, the demand for labor, which really drives us above all, demand for labor really slowed down in the 2000s, and you saw that immigrants started going elsewhere. And that's when immigration became this horrendous, big, problematic question in the East, the Midwest, and so on, and South, because that's where the immigrants are going now, rather than coming to California as they did in the 70s and 80s and 90s. So California is no longer the simple center of immigration, but it's because fundamentally because of our drop-off in our labor demand, which is a bad sign for the future of the state.
I'm speaking with Richard Walker, who is the co-author, along with Suresh Lodha, of The Atlas of California, Mapping the Challenges of a New Era, published by the University of California Press. And, of course, now the battle over the Google bus in San Francisco has become something of a symbol of the social tensions in at least Northern California.
Oh, yeah. I mean, on the immigrant front, I mean, the racial tensions in California are very severe with the big waves of immigration in the 70s and 80s. And California led some of the worst bits of the anti-immigrant movement. The group FAIR, for instance, is headquartered in California. But that's moved east. In California, a lot of the race relations have improved. However, with the new boom, California leads the country in rising real estate values and has since 1970s. In a place like San Francisco, in the middle of the Bay Area, which is now a kind of annex of Silicon Valley, and it's high-tech, the high-tech boom has just driven house prices through the roof. And that means a lot of displacement in the city itself and a lot of unhappiness about that, a lot of evictions, people who simply can't afford to live there anymore, can't afford to raise kids there anymore. So that raised a lot of tensions, which is, you know, it's a strongly class-based against a kind of very favored young high-tech crowd, both workers and the business people, who are often completely oblivious to the past mixture, really kind of very fertile mixture of peoples in the city. And then on the other side, what you have is the people who are being driven out are often going very far away. They went out in droves in the 90s and the 2000s to the very far exurbs, all the way out into the Central Valley, so that the Bay Area actually goes all the way out to Stockton now, in the same way that L.A. goes out beyond Riverside, way out into the desert, or the Inland Empire. And out there you have this large number of people of color, young people of color, trying to set up new families, find housing where they can raise their families, commuting long distances back to the center. And a lot of those people just got wasted by the foreclosure crisis, which was worse in California, really, than anywhere.
And also epicenter of some of that crazy finance as well.
Oh, absolutely. California, we saw the house prices go up. We saw the foreclosures and the collapse of house values out on the urban fringes or in some of the older ghetto neighborhoods and so on. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the financial crisis was not just in Wall Street. The financial bubble was not in Wall Street. The guys who were doling out the mortgages, the freewheeling guys like Mozilla of Countrywide Savings, these guys were in California. They were being fed money from New York, but it was like going through them and then being dished out in huge amounts to California home buyers, who were then the ones that were left out to dry with foreclosures when the whole mess collapsed.
Let's wax Marxist for a moment about the ruling structures of California. Who are the dominant social forces in the governance of California?
Oh, that's an interesting question. It's such a big state that there are several. And in San Francisco, there, for example, there's an old elite, old money, a lot of which goes back to the 19th century, as Gray Brecken, for instance, has written about. But there's a lot of new money, the tech money, huge amounts of money. You know, it's often called the new gold rush, and that's exactly what it is. In L.A., of course, you've got the elite of Hollywood, some of the old aerospace elite, and so on. And then there's, of course, the financial people who've been very strong in San Francisco and very strong in L.A., for a long time. But if you go out in the Central Valley, the agribusiness has a lock on it. These are older families who own big agricultural spreads. They're not usually corporations. They're family or family corporations. And that's a whole other world. And it makes for an interesting political divide because the inland parts of California are so much more conservative than the coast now. It's kind of like a mini map of the United States in terms of red and blue.
And, of course, there's still Orange County being Orange County.
Well, Orange County's changed a lot. The northern part has so many Latinos and Asians who are generally much more liberal than whites. So the voting patterns up there and the people they're sending to Congress have become much more like L.A. You have to go, southern Orange County is still the old Orange County. So things changed a lot. I mean, a lot of the senders of conservatism now are in places like Kern and Fresno County or out in Riverside County, not as much on the coast as it used to be. But, you know, that liberalism covers up an enormous class divide, and California is one of the leading states in the new inequality. We generate huge numbers, more millionaires and billionaires than any other state by far, and our poverty levels are absolutely appalling.
There's certainly no shortage of libertarian thinking that runs around, particularly around the Valley these days. But California has been extraordinarily shaped by state investment. What kind of state contribution to the development of infrastructure in California has there been?
Well, there's a long history of that. It goes back to the railroads and the federal government giving away millions of acres. That happened in California in spades, helped create the great Southern Pacific Empire, going back even to the the dredging of L.A. Harbor in a place where there's really no harbor, and it's now the greatest harbor in the world, in the United States, in North America, and one of the greatest in the world. Tremendous military investment by the government has been huge. It's a kind of infrastructure. It doesn't serve the civilians much, but it's there. It's been the largest military state. And then, of course, post-war, well, even before the war, huge highway developments. California, one of the leading developers of modern highways in the 20s and 30s. And then, of course, the interstate system. So, you know, we were one of the leading freeway states, one of the leading freeway developers in the world, in fact, going back to the 1940s. The water development, tremendous development of aqueducts and dams, aqueducts, delivery systems, storage systems, mostly for agriculture, but also, very importantly, for the cities, done by a variety, and of course, it's done by a variety of state players, from the feds all the way down to city governments. I could go on and on. We had a tremendous school system. We had huge investment. We were really the leader, state leader in higher education in the post-war era. And, of course, a lot of that has turned around and has gone to hell.
Yeah, I want to return to that. But also another aspect of state activity is prison building. That certainly shaped a lot of communities, right?
Yeah, well, one of the sad things is that we changed from waterworks and highways to prisons, and while you can do a lot of criticisms of waterworks and highways, there's really nothing worse you could have focused on in the late 20th century than prisons. And California led the way in the sort of prison industrial complex, what my friend Ruth Gilmore calls the Golden Gulag. We incarcerated more people per capita, per square foot than any place on earth in that period. And it was part of the neoliberal era in California, which I'd love to talk about, and what I would regard as, the decline of the Golden State.
Let's talk some about that. I mean, you've got quite a bit in the Atlas about this. What has happened to the educational system, both K through 12 and then higher ed? It was a leader on the upside, and now it's a leader on the downside.
That's right. I mean, we had some of the first real junior college system, for example, in the early 20th century. So we've got this incredible system of community colleges and CSUs, California State Universities, University of California, multi-campus, and so on. It's the biggest multiple system in the country, one of the biggest in the world. And then K through 12, California pumped huge amounts of money into school building and into per pupil spending back in the post-war era when I was a kid. When most, there were, of course, huge numbers of immigrants, just as many immigrants as there were after 1975, but they were mostly white in my youth and domestic origin and, of course, foreign and brown and so on in the fourth quarter of the 20th century. Well, funny thing, school spending just the bottom fell out. Proposition 13 and other similar moves to cut taxes in California undercut the ability to support schools. School spending went from one of the top five to one of the bottom five in the country. And it's reflected in all the statistics that we muster about high school graduation rates, dropout rates, reading capacity, testing, and so on. California comes in very, very low today. And there's a very simple answer. It doesn't have to do with principals and teachers and so on. It has to do with the fact we don't spend any money. So if you spend the same money as Mississippi, you get Mississippi school system.
Yeah, I was shocked to see California coming in some measures of spending and outcome down in Mississippi levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't just stop with education. It's also true in things like health care, hunger. We have an unbelievable, like one-sixth of the people in California are classified as knowing hunger on a regular basis. Elderly, something like almost half of the elderly need public assistance in California. We have, if you calculate in cost of living, into poverty rates. California has the highest poverty rate in the country. So that's what's so bizarre. We have more billionaires and more millionaires per capita than any place outside of New York City. Well, we have more billionaires even than New York City in total. And then we have the highest poverty rate. I mean, what is going on here? Talk about a class divide. California has really gone down that road, and it's done it in the last 30 years since Proposition 13 passed in 1978. That was the shot heard around the world. It's the equivalent of the New York fiscal crisis in the early 70s was our turn to neoliberalism in the late 70s.
We're listening to an interview with Richard Walker, co-author of The Atlas of California, published by the University of California Press. We'll hear the second part of the interview after a musical break.
This was for all you hard workers out there. Hey, Tim.
That was the Ramones in a live version of California Sun, the Utopian California. Dystopian California coming up at the end of the show. But speaking of dystopian California, there's always this great passage from Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust. All their lives they had slaved at some kind of dull, heavy labor, behind desks and counters in the fields and at tedious machines of all sorts, saving their pennies and dreaming of the leisure that would be theirs once they had enough. Finally that day came. They could draw a weekly income of $10 or $15. Where else should they go but California, the land of sunshine and oranges? Once there, they discover that sunshine isn't enough. They get tired of oranges, even of avocado, pears, and passion fruit. Nothing happens. They don't know what to do with their time. They haven't the mental equipment for pleasure. Did they slave so long just to go to an occasional Iowa picnic? What else is there? They watch the waves come in at Venice. There wasn't any ocean where most of them came from, but after you've seen one wave, you've seen them all. The same is true of the airplanes at Glendale. If only a plane would crash once in a while so that they could watch the passengers being consumed in a holocaust of flame, as the newspapers put it. But the planes never crash. Their boredom becomes more and more terrible. They realize that they've been tricked and burned with resentment. Every day of their lives, they read the newspapers and went to the movies. Both fed them on lynchings, murders, sex crimes, explosions, wrecks, love nests, fires, miracles, revolution, war. This daily diet made sophisticates of them. The sun is a joke. Oranges can't titillate their jaded palates. Nothing can ever be violent enough to make taut their slack minds and bodies. They have been cheated and betrayed. They have slaved and saved for nothing. But that's too dark. It was Nathaniel West, a gloomy fellow. It was the 1930s, a gloomy decade. Back to 2014, in the second part of my interview with Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography at Berkeley, and co-author, along with Suresh Loda, of The Atlas of California, published late last year by the University of California Press. You know, some of what you describe sounds, you know, particularly different, of course, but some of it sounds a lot like New York City, that we have this economy that's very good for people at the top and generates an awful lot of poverty and low-wage service jobs, but not very much in the middle.
That's right. I mean, that's the general pattern in the U.S., which is the worst among all the advanced capitalist countries now in inequality. But, you know, these things are not, as we geographers would insist, these things are not even. You know, if Europe isn't as bad as the United States and, the Scandinavia is the best, in the United States, you had to have leaders. You had to have places setting the standards. Now, we know, for instance, since the Old South sets a lot of the standards in presidential politics and the Republican Party right now and the Tea Party and so on. But what's I think we don't appreciate is that some places like New York and California, maybe more than anywhere, those two places, which are known for their superlatives and their technological and financial and cultural leadership, could also have been leaders in growing inequalities. You know, things like stock options, which are really yet popularized by Silicon Valley, or unstable employment, you know, temp employment, very, very popular in those two places, very important.
Going back to the education, the excellence of the old California public educational system, both primary, secondary, as well as tertiary, was crucial to California's economic success. First of all, outline that contribution, but then what is this savaging of the spending on education doing to the state's economy?
Yeah, I mean, California is built on its labor. You know, the technological development, skilled work, capitalist development in general, the most important input is high-quality labor. For advanced countries, that's absolutely the case. And California has done very well in two regards. And one is we've been able to get the cream of the crop of global labor. I mean, that's one of the ways Silicon Valley is built, is on the brain drain and the brain gain in California, the brain drain from other places. And then the other thing, of course, is educating our own. These huge millions of school kids coming out through this public school system. And, you know, for people in New York, it might come as a surprise, we still have 90% public education in California. When I was a kid, I didn't even know there were private schools. Or if I did, they were like something bizarre, like summer camps, which we didn't have either. So public education was just a way of life in California for a very long time, and in some ways still is. So how public education performs is critical to what kind of labor force we have. And the system was pretty brilliantly organized. I mean, you could argue against it as kind of a typical meritocracy. That is, if you did well in high school, you could jump up to the higher level colleges. But if you didn't particularly do well in high school, but you finally got your high school GED, whatever, you could go to community college and you could catch up. So you always had this kind of last chance system that it works so well, you know, the admission or the allowance of failure worked even in school, but then you could get back in and you could mount up to the ladder. So, and at UC Berkeley, which is the top of the system and is, you know, the equal of Harvard and Yale and the Eastern Ivies, we always had a quarter or a third of our kids were transfers in from community colleges and CSUs, particularly community colleges, these second chance students. So it was a tremendous kind of system for upward mobility of hardworking and intelligent people. And it worked. I mean, it pumped these people into Silicon Valley or wherever, in the everything from the manufacturing arts in community colleges. It could go into automotive work, production work, or there's all kinds of interesting stuff happening in automotives in California over the years, aeronautics or whatever it is, all the way up to, you know, your electrical engineers that go into Silicon Valley or your doctors that are going to go into the big medical technology complex of California.
And now, what's happening?
Well, it's just been deeply undermined. The first crisis to hit was in the early 80s, right after Prop 13 took away the property taxes of local governments. Suddenly, that included local school districts. Suddenly, schools and the local governments are all bankrupt. So then the state had to take over a kind of revenue sharing. Just as revenue sharing was going out at the national level, it was coming in California to go down to the local governments. But then that put this huge new burden at the state level and on its revenues. And so then every time a recession hit, the state would go deeply into the red, much deeper than other states. By far the biggest deficits and the recession of the early 90s, the early 2000s, or of 2008 to 2012, the biggest deficits at the state level by far were California. We took over from New York City as having the second biggest budget in the country and also having the biggest crises in that budget. Now, there were other things that went into it. They capped corporate tax rates. A lot of personal income rates went down. The only thing that stayed up has been some capital gains, but that's highly cyclical, so that doesn't work very well. So a lot of the tax was shifted into sales taxes, very regressive. So, and in general, our tax effort fell, even though the right continued to complain that our taxes were too high. California actually has very moderate taxes. I think it's about 15th in tax effort. We have the figure in the Atlas. Much lower than states like Massachusetts and New York, in fact. So for a very advanced state, we have relatively too low taxes, which means our revenues have been awful. We finally got a little tax increase in the last election, and all of a sudden the revenues, people go, oh, wow, there's a lot more money around. So when the revenues are bad, what gets hurt? First, it was the K-12 got whacked. Then it was in the 90s, after the recession, early 90s, it was the community colleges got whacked. And then by the early 2000s, it was the state universities. UCs, we were much more privileged. We were kind of the Ivy League of California. And it didn't really clobber us until the Great Recession hit. And then the cuts have been, they were 30%. Probably upwards of 50% in most budgets. So that's a pretty gigantic cut out of your operating operations.
And do the titans of the valley just assume they can import the skilled labor now rather than producing it domestically?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. They can either import it or they'll subcontract it from abroad. And, of course, the titans of Silicon Valley, about half of them are now, the startups are of Asian origin, or Chinese, Indian mostly. So they do a lot of business with, and even startups back in Asia. So they have this much more global sense of labor forces and labor needs. And at the same time, the labor demands are more and more elite in the Valley because they do less and less actual production.
And so has this ripened as a political issue? The quality of the schools, from parents worrying about the quality of the schools, but also anybody worried about the economic impact of these education cuts over the long term, or is it just people shrugging their shoulders complacently?
Well, I think the complacency is a big part of it. I think people, ordinary people, working class people, have been very concerned, and with some of the elite worrying along with them. So, for example, in 1998, Californians voted for a proposition that would to try to control the cuts in K-12 education. It's worked very imperfectly, to say the least, but at least kind of stopped the worst of the bleeding, kind of a little tourniquet on the amputated leg there. And then in the 2000s, I think people much more slow to react to the cuts in higher education. I think that's harder for, your mass of, say, second-generation Latinos to relate directly to, whereas they're very concerned about K-12 schools right now. But people learning, students starting to protest. The problem is I don't see a lot of the Silicon Valley elite, Southern California elite, I haven't seen a really strong reaction in defense of the schools and universities. Generally, the line that's accepted amongst the elite is for higher education is you get what you pay for. So it's that total flip around to a neoliberal rationale from the post-war New Deal rationale, which is that education is a public investment, to the neoliberal rationale, which is that education is something you pay for, and then you get higher returns for, so you make a profit on your personal capital.
So it's a shift from a public accounting to a private accounting framework.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's just appalling. And I've been amazed at what a lonely voice I was, and just a handful of us in the Berkeley Faculty Association trying to fight the cut, even amongst faculty. I don't even know if they get it. So, you know, neoliberalism runs so deep, the belief in the sort of personal, liberal, you know, market rationality of capitalism runs so deep in the U.S. and has gotten so much worse that people don't even remember what mass public investment was. They don't even, you know, fortunately we have this one memory, which is the master plan of 1960. It didn't actually establish the higher education system, but it kind of wrapped it up with a bow and said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have this tripartite system. And we're going to pump all this money into it and so on. That was written by that old New Deal liberal, Clark Kerr, who was then president of the university. But he got chased out. He was sacked by Ronald Reagan, and that was the beginning of the end.
Ronald Reagan, your gift to the rest of the United States and to the world.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think Phil Evington at USC has written a wonderful article about this, but something I've believed for a long time, which is in Southern California in particular, you know, did kind of run the United States for a while. And, our gifts are many, and they keep on giving, from Dick Nixon through Ronald Reagan, and a lot of his cabinet came out of California. And even today, I mean, today maybe we're getting a bit of a turnaround. I think California's gotten much, much better thanks to mostly to its immigrants and children of immigrants. But otherwise, our elites are, what are they delivering to the world? They're delivering a lot of great toys, but not a lot of social responsibility.
I'm speaking with Richard Walker, who is the co-author, along with Suresh Loda, of The Atlas of California, Mapping the Challenges of a New Era, published by the University of California Press. And to another gloomy topic, climate change. California now in the midst of a very serious drought. I just read an article yesterday suggesting that it might be a 200-year drought, whatever that means precisely. But what's climate change doing to the state?
In general, the models of climate change say that California will get more variability on top of our existing high variability of climate because we sit on a boundary. We sit on the boundary between the desert areas and the wet northwest. And all it has to do is for that jet stream to wander too far north or too far south to change our climate. And so that's what happens year to year and even month to month. It's pretty dramatic. It's one of the oddest, one of the oddest climates, if not the oddest in the United States. It's the Mediterranean climate of the United States. Okay, so more variation, probably because we'll get warmer in general. We'll have less snow, which is very bad because the snow is a big storage system, like a huge reservoir for the summer runoff. And nobody knows for sure if we'll get wetter or drier, but it'll probably vary a lot by place. And we might get a little wetter in the north and a little drier in the south, but nobody knows for sure because of that funny business. But the variability is important. And even without climate change, people are absolutely blind to this. I mean, I've known this since I first was a bushy-tailed junior professor, and I was teaching a course on water that I had been assigned, and you just look at tree ring records because we have a lot of old trees in California, and bristlecone pines and so on. You can go back 4,000 years, and you can see that the record of wet and dry years is extremely erratic, with droughts that last 20 years, low water eras that last 50 years, and that those are absolutely the norm. And you've got a water system built on the expectation of the last 50 years max and pushing the natural supplies of water to their limit to develop every inch of agriculture and urban pavement you can. And this just can't last. You just can't go on like that in a more variable world.
Agriculture is still very important to California, and California agriculture very important to the rest of the United States. So what's the climate change going to do to the agricultural business?
Yeah, agribusiness is generally underestimated in its importance today. People go, oh, it's all high tech and Hollywood, but it's still might be, along with food processing, which is double the amount, the value of crops, it could be almost 10% of the California economy. And it's by far the biggest state in the United States, agriculture, by far. Huge exporter, very advanced, and, of course, extremely bad treatment of its workers. So agriculture gets 80% of the water still, or 75%. Okay, I'll be kind to them, only 75%. But that, you can see that's a huge slug of the water, and because this isn't just rainfall we're talking about. This is water you've got to store and move and pump. It's expensive water. It's really precious water. And so you can't just throw it around. Now, California agribusiness has been very productive, very profitable. A lot of it in the better parts of the state, like along the western slope of Sierra Nevada, where there's lots of rivers, lots of groundwater. It's a wonderful place to farm. But there are some parts of it, like the western and southern San Joaquin Valley, the southern part of the Great Central Valley, that are naturally extremely dry. I mean, they're desert, basically, have lousy water tables. So you got to pump hundreds of feet. And so they're completely dependent on imported water. And it just doesn't work. It just doesn't make sense.
So what's going to happen to it? Is it going to dry up and blow away?
Here's the politics of California. Agribusiness has always been the tail that wagged the dog in California. And a lot of urbanites in California have no idea about this, let alone people on the East Coast. But these guys, they've had the power to wag the federal dog. Think of the Bracero program or the 1986 Immigration Act, you know, where they always get clauses for farm workers in there. And their power to get the Bureau of Reclamation and the Corps of Engineers to do their bidding on the Colorado and Sacramento rivers. And state government, they can always get a lot out of, including a giant water project of its own. And you know, at the level of county governments, city governments in the valleys, forget it. I mean, these are the judges, the cops, everybody works for agribusiness. So it's a very powerful system.
Despite its political power, if nature will not cooperate, can the agribusiness survive on this scale?
Right. I mean, well, this is it. The only check on their power is reality. Because politically, you've just seen there's this absolute farce going on where Obama flew out to go to the Central Valley, was met by our two senators, who are supposedly Democrats. One of them is actually Barbara Boxer, who's quite liberal. Dianne Feinstein might as well be a Republican. She is, after all, probably the richest member of the U.S. Senate. And they all met in the Southern Central Valley to say, yeah, the federal government, we're really going to help you out in this drought. Well, what are they going to do? There's no more water. The reservoirs, like Shasta reservoirs, it's something like 17% of its capacity. The reservoirs in the north are all empty. And there is no water to deliver. So the only way they can make this happen, of course, is that these pathetic releases that the environmentalists and the fishermen got a few years back through a long legal fight, got a few more releases of a few 100,000 acre feet so that all the salmon and steelhead and so on could run in the spring and the fall when the rivers are dry from the pumping. Especially in summer and fall. So these guys make it sound like, oh, it's the environmentalist's fault and not nature's fault. And then on top of it, Jerry Brown, our supposedly liberal Democratic governor, his Christmas present to agribusiness is a plan to drill two giant tunnels under the Sacramento Delta to deliver the entire Sacramento River to the pumps that go south. And this costs, you know, people hear a lot about high-speed rail in California. This is going to cost as much as high-speed rail. And it's preposterous because they're going to deliver this water that we don't have. And of course, it'll be absolutely just destroy the San Francisco Bay estuary system. And I don't know what's gotten into Brown's head, except that his father's great legacy, one of his great legacies, was the California Water Project. So I think Jerry wants to, it's kind of like George Bush Jr. trying to live up to daddy's expectations. At least it's not a war, but it's certainly a war on the environment.
It sounds like Oedipal's struggles are not good for politics.
It does sound that way, indeed. I mean, talk about a permanent elite. I mean, this reproduction we get in the United States these days of these family dynasties is absolutely not healthy.
Yeah, well, this actually leads me to my final question. You know, that kind of reproduction of dynasty and just general sense that the United States is its best days maybe behind us, that we're kind of rotting maybe from the center or out from the edges towards the center or whatever, but it does feel like a rot. And certainly you can see this in California. Do you think that the state is up to all these challenges, the environmental challenge, the educational challenge, the challenge of social division? Or is the California dream evaporating?
Well, you know, I love to be negative, and I love to cite all the figures that show how bad things are, because people absolutely need to be shocked into consciousness. And at the same time, I remain kind of an optimist in a funny way. I do think that. Good sign about California. A couple of good things about California. One is we still have a very strong economic base. So you don't have to pander to the lowest common denominator. I mean, this is a technological center of the world. And I mean, there's no doubt about that. We're not being threatened by the Germans or the Chinese or the Japanese or anyone. This thing is going hell to leather as before, and it's doing it through, you know, a lot of bright young people doing exciting new things. I mean, that's if you like Twitter. But, okay, putting that aside. And then the second good thing is that our mass immigration in the 70s and 80s left us with a mass populous electorate of color. And these folks are much more liberal than the old backward whites that have dominated this country and still dominate California. I didn't get into that, but if you look at the neoliberalism of California from the 1970s to 2000, it's all voted for through propositions, it's public support, but by a very restricted white electorate, kind of on the southern model. And, not quite Jim Crow, but it's a lot like it. But now the electorate has turned around dramatically. You can see it in the election result. You know, California, the Republicans haven't got a prayer in California. It's a Democratic state. Of course, that means we have lots of conservative Democrats. But it's still the kind of sweeping electoral changes and the energy from below of these kids of color coming up through the state schools and universities. You know, that's pretty wonderful. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we've turned the corner. We're living a different kind of American society than most of the country. It's a much more mixed society. It's a much more open and queer society in a lot of ways. And electorally, it's reflecting that. So I think there's some hope. But the problem is, of course, the elite, including the Silicon Valley elite, is still overwhelmingly white, male, and getting filthy rich, which doesn't incline them to anything better than libertarianism.
That was Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography at Berkeley and co-author, along with Suresh Loda, of The Atlas of California, published late last year by the University of California Press. Dick is spending a lot of time now at a house he recently bought in France, in Burgundy to be precise, because he couldn't afford to buy one in Berkeley. I'm reminded of Robert Frost's poem, New Hampshire. Not because of this bit. I met a Californian who would talk California. A state so blessed, he said, in climate none had ever died there. A natural death. And vigilance committees had to organize to stock the graveyards and vindicate the state's humanity. No, not because of that passage, but because of the last line of Frost's poem, concluding 400 lines in praise of New Hampshire with a disclosure, "At present I am living in Vermont." That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Bad Religion's Los Angeles is Burning. Till next week, bye.